you're here. If you want to open your Bibles to Matthew 8, Mark 5, and Luke 8. Okay, so if you could, somehow we were going to go back and forth between those three contexts. But we've studied for a while the parables of Jesus and what he taught about the kingdom and about our responsibilities in the kingdom and how to enter the kingdom. And lately, the lesson number 10 has been a lot about his time up around, again, returning to the Sea of Galilee in that area. And again, he's been performing miracles. And the most recent miracle that we talked about is what?
The calming
of the sea. I'm
sorry?
Calming the sea. Calming the sea, yes. He was out on the Sea of Galilee in the boat with his disciples. And so we finished that last week. And again, just remembering these lessons, the humanity and the divinity of Jesus. It was he who slept and needed to sleep, who also with the word, by his word, simply told the wind and the sea to hush and to be still. We talked about the fact that, again, all things and all people are subject to Christ. Again, he is Lord of all. In fact, he's Lord of the elements of this earth, and all things are subject to him. We talked about the fact that we need to focus in on the spiritual, and we sometimes focus on the temporal things of life, but it is the spiritual that we need to focus on. And indeed, there are going to be difficult physical circumstances, but it's those spiritual storms that we need to, again, make sure that we have faith in Jesus. And we need to remember that as the disciples asked Jesus, "Do you not care?" to remember that he does care. And again, he knows, and we talked about the fact that, you know, from Hebrews chapter 4, how can he care about our challenges, our trials and temptations? How is it that he can truly care?
He's been there.
He's been there. Again, as we say, been there, done that. He's been through the trials and temptations. He's been tempted in all forms as we are. And we can approach him as our high priest in that way. And again, perhaps most importantly, simply the need for faith. We need to trust him. We need to believe in him. And one of the things before we go to God in a word of prayer in just a moment, it was brought up last week in terms of how much, and remember in the book of Mark, it was said by Jesus to them, "Do you still have no faith?" And we talked about the fact that by reason of time, by reason of evidence that's presented, Jesus isn't asking them to have faith without any evidence presented to them, but they have. And we kind of talked about how many miracles has Jesus already performed. And again, I think I mentioned last week, I've got a chart that kind of lists all of them. But here's all the miracles that already he has performed. He converted water, converted wine, healed the nobleman's son, the great catch of fish, he healed the demoniac, Peter's mother-in-law, cleansing the leper, the paralyzed man, the immobile man. Again, that was when he told take up the pallet and walk. Restoring the withered hand, the centurion's servant, the widow's son, the demoniac, stilling the storm, as we just talked about. And now we're going to be talking about casting out demons. And so, do you still not yet have faith after all of these miracles that has been presented to them? The other thing I want to point out is that we mentioned last week is, where are we in terms of, again, the life of Christ, his ministry? In general, how long was his ministry? A little over 3 years. Again, there are four Passovers that are mentioned. And again, this chart identifies the first, second, third, and fourth Passover. So again, there's 1 year between each of those. And where we're at in the life of Christ already is approximately, we're just coming up on John chapter 6, in which the third Passover was observed by Christ. So already we're a little over 2 years into his ministry. 2 years of teaching, 2 years again of miracles that have been performed. And so that kind of, I thought it was a good point to step back and say, where are we during the ministry and during his time upon the earth? And to remember, again, how important it was that he teach when he had the opportunity to teach, And to present the evidence, he had the opportunity to present. We serve a mighty Savior. Indeed, he has evidenced who he was before us, and we're going to take a look at more evidence tonight. All right. If I can get some of us to read, we're going to talk about Jesus casting out a lot of demons. And let me just preface by this, Mickey and I were talking before class. Deuteronomy 29:29 says what? The secret things... God keeps secret, the things revealed,
and he's told us.
That belongs to us. When it comes to demon possession, I only know what the scriptures reveal. There's a lot I don't understand, but there are lessons that we need to learn from what Jesus did regarding those who did have demons, and we need to trust those things that we don't understand. So let me just kind of preface by saying that, as I said upon this, that your mind kind of wonders in terms of, again, wow, this is something that's kind of over my head. And indeed, again, there are things that, again, God has not revealed a lot on. But the point we need to focus on tonight is the relationship between Jesus, again, these demons, and his power and his authority and his might. If I can get someone to read, first of all, Matthew 8:28-34, we're going to read all four contexts because we will be bouncing back and forth. So let's start with Matthew 8, Carolyn.
Matthew 8:28-34. When he came to the other side, into the country of the Gadarenes, two men who were demon-possessed met him as they were coming out of the tombs. They were so extremely violent that no one could pass by that way. And they cried out, saying, "What business do we have with each other, Son of God? Have you come here to torment us before the time?" Now there was a herd of many swine feeding at a distance from them. The demons began to entreat him, saying, "If you are going to cast us out, send us into the herd of swine." And he said to them, "Go." And they came out and went into the swine, and the whole herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea and perished in the waters. The herdsmen ran away and went to the city and reported everything, including what had happened to the demoniacs. And behold, the whole city came out to meet Jesus, and when they saw him, they implored him to leave their region.
All right, thank you. And in Mark 5, 1 through 21, who has that? Melissa?
Mark 5,
1
through 21?
Yes. 1 through 20, yeah.
1 through 20.
They came to the other side of the sea, into the country of the Gerasenes. When he got out of the boat, immediately a man from the tombs with an unclean spirit met him. And he had his dwelling among the tombs, and no one was able to bind him anymore, even with a chain, because he had often been bound with shackles and chains, and the chains had been torn apart by him, and the shackles broken in pieces, and no one was strong enough to subdue him. Constantly, night and day, he was screaming among the tombs and in the mountains and gashing himself with stones. Seeing Jesus from a distance, he ran up and bowed down before him, and shouting with a loud voice, he said, "What business do we have with each other, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I implore you by God, do not torment me." For he had been saying to him, "Come out of the man, you unclean spirit." And he was asking him, "What is your name?" And he said to him, My name is Legion, for we are many." And he began to implore him earnestly not to send them out of the country. Now there was a large herd of swine feeding nearby in the mountains. The demons implored him, saying, "Send us into the swine so that we may enter them." Jesus gave them permission, and coming out, the unclean spirits entered the swine. And the herd rushed down the steep bank into the sea, about 2,000 of them, and they were drowned in the sea. Their herdsmen ran away and reported it in the city and in the country, and the people came out to see what it was that had happened. They came to Jesus and observed the man who had been demon-possessed, sitting down, clothed and in his right mind, the very man who had had the legion, and they became frightened. Those who had seen it described to them how it had happened to the demon-possessed man and all about the swine. And they began to implore him to leave their region. As he was getting into the boat, the man who had been demon-possessed was imploring him that he might accompany him. And he did not let him, but said to him, Go home to your people and report to them what great things the Lord has done for you. And now he has had mercy on you. And he went away and began proclaiming in Decapolis what great things Jesus had done for him, and everyone was amazed.
All right, thank you. So again, a little bit more detail offered by Mark, and now Luke 8:26-40. Thank you, Jenny.
Then they sailed to the country of the Gerasenes, which is opposite Galilee. When Jesus had stepped out on land, there met him a man from the city who had demons. For a long time he had worn no clothes, and he had not lived in a house but among the tombs. When he saw Jesus, he cried out and fell down before him, and said with a loud voice, What have you to do with me, Jesus, Son of the Most High God? I beg you, do not torment me. For he had commanded the unclean spirit to come out of the man. For many a time it had seized him. He was kept under guard and bound with chains and shackles, but he would break the bonds and be driven by the demon into the desert. Jesus then asked him, What is your name? And he said, Legion, for many demons had entered him. And they begged him not to command them to depart into the abyss. Now a large herd of pigs was feeding there on the hillside, and they begged him to let them enter these. So he gave them permission. Then the demons came out of the man and entered the pigs, and the herd rushed down the steep bank into the lake and drowned. When the herdsmen saw what had happened, they fled and told it in the city and the country. Then people went out to see what had happened, and they came to Jesus and found the man from whom the demons had gone, sitting at the feet of Jesus, clothed and in his right mind, and they were afraid. And those who had seen it told them how the demon-possessed man had been healed. Then all the people of the surrounding country of the Gerasenes asked him to depart from them, for they were seized with great fear. So he got into the boat and returned. The man from whom the demons had gone begged that he might be with him. But Jesus sent him away, saying, Return to your home and declare how much God has done for you. And he went away, proclaiming throughout the whole city how much Jesus had done for him.
All right. Thank you. So, as we read these contexts, first of all, physically, where was he? Matthew records that when he came to the other side of the country of the Gadarenes, we read in both Mark and Luke, they identify the country of the Gerasenes. Now, if you look that up in various Bible dictionaries, they'll tell you that, again, they're basically referring to the same areas. And what I understand is, if you can see this on the map, that Gadara is down here, and it was the larger city, which kind of indicated the general region. Gergesa is a smaller community, and again, that would be the Gerasenes. The Gadarenes would be representing the city of Gadara, but that kind of described the larger area, as it were. This the smaller city, again, was kind of included with that region of the Gadarenes. So again, that's what I understand. You can look up more of that in a Bible dictionary. But that's so they're on the eastern side of the Sea of Galilee, where this happened. Now, we read just a moment ago in Matthew 8:28 that two men who were demon-possessed met him as they were coming out of the tombs. Did you notice in Mark and Luke the same reference? Yeah, both Mark and Luke indicated one demon-possessed man. They refer to a man with an unclean spirit. And the conversation, the interaction then, was with one man. Now, again, does that indicate a discrepancy in the scriptures? Would it be a discrepancy to say that there were two men who were demon-possessed, but Jesus had a conversation with one of them? That there was one conversation with one of them, but there were two, again, who had interacted with him? They simply focused on Jesus' interaction with just one of these two men. All right? And we learn from Luke chapter 8 and verse 30, and also Mark in chapter 5 verse 13, that there were many demons who had entered into the one man. Do we know exactly how many? No, but there are a lot. Okay? What were the characteristics of these demon-possessed men, as we just read a moment ago?
Violent.
I'm sorry?
Violent.
Naked.
I'm
sorry?
Naked.
Yeah, they're naked. What else?
Strong.
Could anybody control them? Okay.
And apparently not living at home.
Yeah. So again, they were extremely violent. Unable to be bound by chains or shackles or subdued. Nobody could control them. They were constantly screaming and gnashing themselves. A pretty picture, isn't it? Okay. Unclothed for a long time. Again, this wasn't just a isolated moment. And so again, how would you react if you knew over in this area there were two men who were extremely violent, unable to be bound, constantly screaming, unclothed? Would you want to be near them? No. And so it's not a surprise that all these things caused the others to pass by another way. Again, they would go around them, and they were well known. They wouldn't go anywhere near them. Now, these unclean spirits, and especially in the one that Jesus interacted with and had this conversation with, what did they say? What did they do, first of all?
They came and bowed down to him.
Okay, they recognized Jesus from a distance. They recognized him from afar, the demons did. Seeing Jesus from a distance, he ran up and bowed down. He fell down before him. We point out that the apostles and others, when others would fall down before them, did they ever accept that? No. So what did we learn already from about these demons? And what did they then understand about Jesus? He's the Son of God. Okay. And they recognized his authority, absolutely, and their submission to that. We see further as we go along in this conversation, their words represent or indicate their submission. They realize who's in control here. Jesus is. And they shouted at Jesus, what? What business do we have with you? What do we have to do with you? The American Standard says, what have we to do with thee, thou Son of God? The ESV says, what have you to do with us, O Son of God? What relationship do we have together? Do they understand they had no business with Jesus? They realized that there was no communion, as it were. In Mark chapter 5, verse 7, additionally, Mark records, Son of the Most High God, they say, as we think about these demons. And again, there's a lot we don't know, but what we do know, they knew Jesus. And they recognized the one supreme God of all to whom they were subject to. What do we read in James chapter 2 and verse 19?
The demons believe in
God and they shudder. The demons know who, again, they believe in God. And they're scared and they shudder in the presence of God. Okay, yeah, they recognize again their position. Luke chapter 4. Can I get somebody to read verse 33 through 35? Luke chapter 4, 33 through 35.
Then the demons went out of the man and entered the swine and was hurried violently down.
No. Luke 4, 33 through 35. Richard, do you have that?
Yeah. It says, and in the synagogue there was a man that had a spirit of an unclean demon, and he cried out with a loud voice, Ah, what have we to do with thee, Jesus, thou Nazarene? Art thou come to destroy us? I know thee who thou art, the Holy One of God. And Jesus rebuked him, saying, Hold thy peace and come out of him. And when the demon had thrown him down in the midst, he came out of him, having done him no hurt.
So again, we see a previous example of Jesus casting out a demon. Again, the demon says, What do we have to do with you? Leave us alone. Have you come to destroy us? And by that, indicates judgment. Have you come to judge us, to destroy us in judgment? they recognize again the power of judgment that Jesus has. And so I just wanted to point out that we have studied already. And so they recognize no commonality, no fellowship at all between them and Jesus. In 2 Corinthians chapter 6 and verse 15, what do we read there? Again, as you think about the end of chapter 5, he's talking about being reconciled to God. But then in chapter 6, he begins to talk about you, as one reconciled to God, you can't be together with things that are evil or wicked. And he says what?
What concord hath Christ with Belial, or what portion hath a believer with an unbeliever?
And in all these lists of questions, the answer is
no.
Nothing. There is no fellowship, there's no commonality. And it's interesting, again, these demons understand that we don't have anything in common with you. What do you have with us? What do we have with you? And the answer is nothing. And they understood, as we've kind of indicated already, they understood Jesus' power and authority to torment them, to judge them, to condemn them. And that all they could do was what?
Plead.
To plead, to beg. With Jesus, not to do so, what? Before the time. I find that interesting. Did they understand a time was coming? They sure did. They understood judgment was coming. Kind of a lesson, do we know that? The demons understood that. Indicating the awareness that, again, that torment was coming. Luke records they were imploring him not to command them to go away into the abyss. In Luke chapter 8 and verse 31, one commentary points out, thus attempting to avoid the immediate judgment to eternal place of suffering. Again, they had that understanding of eternal suffering, and they knew that that time was coming. Again, we talked about the parable of the wheat and the tares, and understanding the separation that was going to come. And sometimes we as people here, do we think often enough about that day of judgment, that day of separation? But yet these demons were well aware of that. They knew the time was coming. What does Jesus ask in regards to this one he has a conversation with? What does he ask him?
What's your name?
What's your name? And he said, Legion, for many demons had entered him, referring to the man's condition and not his given name. This is not to say that that man's birth name was Legion. It's describing his condition. Mark chapter 5 and verse 9 reads, my name is Legion, for we are many. Again, indicating it's the voice, as it were, of the demons that possessed him. A legion in the Old Testament represented a group of 4,000 to 6,000 soldiers in the Roman army. Okay, so it's interesting, and I'm not drawing a conclusion to say there were, you know, 4,000 to 6,000 demons with him. We know they were many, okay? But it's interesting that that was the word that was used as, my name is Legion. Jesus then had authority over these demons. They were subject to him. And we read in Mark chapter 5 and verse 8 that he had been saying, come out of the man, you unclean spirit. Again, he was exercising authority over them. And as he was exercising authority over them, the demon had a request. The demons had a request, the many of them. And what were they requesting, as we pointed out? First of all, don't send us into the abyss. Don't torment us before the time. But they had a request.
Send us into the swine.
If you, again, they were imploring him. They were begging him, pleading with Jesus. Jesus, who they recognized all authority was his. Again, I was thinking about Ephesians chapter 1. At the end of that chapter, Paul describes Jesus at the right hand of God having authority over what? Everything. Again, in the heavenly places, all spiritual beings, all human beings, he has all authority. They were imploring him, begging of him not to command them to go into the abyss Or in Mark chapter 5 and verse 10, interestingly, not to send them out of the country. Do demons live in a physical realm that they can cross a physical border?
Those did.
Well, those did, but again, what realm were they not wanting to be commanded out of? And did this world and into, again, that place of torment. And they said that if you then cast us out, send us into the herd of swine. That was what they asked. They didn't want the judgment to come yet. Are we like the demons and we're pleading perhaps with Jesus, don't bring judgment upon me yet? There was indeed a herd of swine, wasn't there? A large herd of swine feeding nearby on the mountain. And they implored him to permit them to enter the swine. It's interesting the phrasing of this. Jesus what? Gave permission. You are allowed. Did they have that? Was that their, you know, could they do that without Jesus' permission? No. They were subject to, again, Jesus allowing them to do that. Jesus gave that permission. As commanded by the authority of Jesus, the demons came out of the man and entered the swine. And the herd, which we read in Mark chapter 5, verse 13, was about, think about this, 2,000 swine. 2,000. I've never seen that many pigs or swine in one place at one time.
That's a lot of people. They're trying to answer the question about the legions.
Well, again, I don't know enough to say, you know, was it one demon per pig? I don't know that. It's just a lot, yes. It's a lot. And what did these 2,000 pigs do once they were allowed to go out of the man and enter the swine? They rushed down the steep bank and into the lake. And they were drowned, 2,000 of them. 2,000 pigs as it were stampeding down a hill into a lake. Can you imagine? What if you're those who are in charge of the pigs and you just watched?
You just kind of hope they were wild.
What a sight that must have been. What was the reaction then to those who saw what happened?
They ran into the city to go tell everybody what they just saw.
I mean, we see something happen, you know, we see some accident, we see something happen, and, you know, we get on our phones, we have to tell somebody about it. They don't have the ability to text or email. They go into the city and they tell. The herdsmen ran away. And again, I think, there was some urgency to that. They could not believe what they had just seen. And they ran away and reported it in the city and in the country. And the people came to see what it was that had happened. You can almost get the idea that the people ran into the city to tell them about, and they're perhaps stammering and trying to explain what happened. And they're like, I'm going to go see that for myself. And then the rest of the people came out to see what had happened. And the people came to Jesus, we read in Luke chapter 8, verse 35, and found the man whom the demons had gone out. Did they know who he was? Again, they knew that he was the one who was screaming, he was shouting, he was uncontrollable, he was unclothed.
Yeah. Interesting thought. They not only knew who that man was, but they were well acquainted with this man in his former condition, that he could not be controlled.
Right.
And neither could these 2,000 swine be controlled.
No.
The herdsmen could do nothing about it.
And when the city and the people came, how did they see this man who had been out of control? Sitting calmly.
Wearing clothes.
I'm sorry?
Wearing clothes.
Yeah. Wearing clothes, I think, said being composed, and both of those would
sure,
fit.
Why not?
Yeah, clothed and composed. And would that be startling again if you had known and you had stayed wary of and gone around to avoid this man for a long time, and all of a sudden now you come out and he's quiet, he's controlled, he's composed, he's clothed. government oppression would that have on you? And witnesses then were there and gave account of how he had been made well. Luke chapter 8, verse 36, which the word actually means when it says made well, he was saved. I'm not talking about spiritually saved to mean that Jesus, by casting out demons, forgave him of his sins. It means, again, that he was saved from that condition. But it is that word that's used elsewhere in the New Testament to describe spiritual salvation. He had been saved. In Acts chapter 16, again in verse 30, it's the same word that's used there, where we read the jailer saying, "Sirs, what must I do to be saved?" Same word that's used there. Now, what is it that the people then, having seen this man, having heard the first-hand accounts of these 2,000 swine and how they had rushed into the sea and drowned, and they've taken all this in, and their reaction is what? Their reaction, all the people asked, it means to implore. They begged with Jesus to leave them, for they were gripped with fear. Please leave us. Does that make sense? Why would these people ask Jesus to leave them? I'm sorry? Well, certainly, again, perhaps they felt uncomfortable, and what would they recognize about Jesus from this? His power, his authority.
They were afraid of him.
Are we to fear God? Yes. Fear does one of two things, really, to us. Fear either causes us in humility to draw closer to him with reverence and respect, or in the case of this type of fear, what does it cause some people to do? They get away from me. Separation. I don't want to. And it made me think, again, not a fear of awe and reverence. Again, there's that fear of God in which we, again, are in awe of who he is and what he can do, and that we revere him. But there's also, like we see here, a fear, a cowardly fear. Afraid of perhaps what else? Had these owners of these swine lost a lot? Yeah? We think about what else might it cost us if this man with this power stays around us. And it made me think for just a moment, this is just a reflection of what I thought about. In 2 Samuel chapter 6, what had David just witnessed?
The killing of Uzzah.
Because
he touched the ark.
And because of his irreverence and how they carried the ark. And what was David's reaction to Uzzah dying because of his irreverence regarding the ark and God?
Because he was afraid of Jehovah that day.
They were afraid, and what did they do with the ark?
They left it in the house of Obed-Edom.
Send it away. Did David kind of have that same reaction of fear? And then instead of wanting to draw near to God at that point in time and say, and realizing, as he did later, the need to bring in the ark the proper way with reverence and fear, at that moment he reacted in fear and said, get the ark out of here. Send it away. And do we sometimes, again, maybe because of our sinfulness, we think about Luke, again, when he realized it was Peter who realized the power of God when they brought in that great haul of fish. And Peter came to the shore, and what did he say to Jesus? Remember, depart from me, O Lord, for I am what? I'm a sinful man. So to that respect, again, sometimes, and when we think about that aspect of realizing our sinfulness, remember Isaiah chapter 6, when Isaiah saw the throne room of God, what was his reaction? Woe is me, for I'm undone, I live amongst those of unclean lips. He realizes his own sinfulness and the sinfulness of the people he lived around, right around him. Acts chapter 5, again, when we think about how people react to the fear of God, in Acts chapter 5, verses 1 through 11, what are we reading about?
Ananias
and Sapphira, both of them
lied
and died, yes, in 5. And what was the reaction again to that judgment upon them?
Great fear.
Great fear. But what if somebody could read verse 11 through 13 of Acts 5, Richard, do you have it?
Yeah. And great fear came upon the whole church and upon all that heard these things. And by the hands of the apostles were many signs and wonders wrought among the people. And they were all with one accord in Solomon's porch. But of the rest, there's no man joined himself to them, howbeit the people magnified them.
Do you see a different reaction to the fear here? The fear caused some to do what? To actually join this group. They realized reverently, this is great power. We need to submit to them. But it says there in verse 13, the rest of them what? I don't want to associate with them. I want to keep my distance. Again, that aspect of fear, it should draw us closer to God reverently, fearfully. But again, for many, again, it's like these people. Lord, go somewhere else.
Depends on the state of your heart.
It does, absolutely. It's a choice, isn't it? Whether or not we're going to humble ourselves and realize again that I'm a sinful man and I need you and I'm coming to you as a penitent sinner. Or, again, why do some people, as it were, reject Jesus out of their lives out of fear? Because they don't want to change. Again, when we humble ourselves and come before Him, we recognize, I'm going to have to change some things. But again, if you don't want to change your life at all, you don't want to repent. Many of those people, I don't want the Lord in my life. I don't want to be around the Bible because I know what's going to tell me. I don't want to listen to Jesus in His Word because I know I'm going to feel uncomfortable. You think in the book of Acts, who else was brought to fear and, as it were, also again, sent, as it were, Jesus and His apostles away? We just studied in the book of Acts. Agrippa?
Well, Felix
is. I'm sorry, you're right. Felix is, yeah. What was Felix's reaction to, again, the fear of God, as it were?
Go away, I'll call you.
Yeah, go away. I'll call for you if I want you. Again, I just see it's an interesting reaction to those who saw the power of God in a great and demonstrative way. And yet their reaction, hearing the account, seeing what happened, they go, leave. Interesting.
I just thought, excuse me, Chris, with the fear, if he could do this in this situation, if I'm a sinner, what's he going to do to me?
Right.
You know, fear for my life.
Right. But again, it's up to us to choose, again, to humble ourselves, to recognize that, or to say, like, Felix, I prefer to stay this way. I really don't want to change. Carolyn?
Simon the Sorcerer changed, and then he kind of fell back seemingly pretty quickly, and then asked for prayer to, you know, that might not happen. So he seems like one who might have realized very quickly what he'd done, and
yeah.
Maybe made a turn.
Again, our fear should cause us, when there is sin in our lives, like Simon, to again, I don't want to be in this place. I don't want to be in this condition. And you know, pray for me. Absolutely. Now, what about this man who had been healed? What did he say to Jesus?
Come with you.
Please. And again, it wasn't a casual. Luke records he was begging Jesus that he might accompany him. He was begging Jesus, I want to go with you. That's an interesting reaction. What did Jesus have to say in return?
Going down.
Okay. No. Basically, no. I'm not. I don't want you to come with me. But I have work for you to do. I need you to go back. I need to go back to where you're from, return to your house, and describe what great things God has done for you.
And just a semantic thing, but it's not, no, but I have something. It's no, because I have things, something to do for you.
Yes.
Jesus had this plan in mind already.
Yes. Okay.
Yeah. Work the job that man to do.
I'm in the job for you. Yeah. And if you're with me, you can't go and do what I need you to do.
Right.
It's, again, there presents the idea of opportunities. Who alone had the opportunity to go and tell the people of his town what Jesus had done? Who could do it better than him? That was his opportunity. That was his open door. And Jesus urged him to take it. Again, we think about the journeys of Paul and how that, again, that the Holy Spirit sometimes reject Paul's idea in terms of where he should go. He wanted to go in Asia, and again, he was told no. Again, God understands, and the idea of opportunity is there also in the journeys of Paul. So again, go and tell what great things God has done for you.
And who better qualified than this man?
Yeah. Now, nobody, again, it kind of, when you phrase that, makes me think about, like when Mordecai talked to Esther, this is your opportunity. You're the one with this opportunity to go before the king. And Jesus to this man is, this is your moment. I mean, you're the one, and nobody can go and tell the people of your town better than you. Is it commendable that he wanted to remain with Jesus? Sure. Do we understand that? Yes. But again, as Richard and Mickey pointed out, there was work Jesus needed him to do. And again, it's kind of one of those, seize the moment. If he was the right person, and when was the right time?
Right now.
Right now. The time was now, and he was the person. And to his credit, what did he do? He obeyed. He did what Jesus asked him to do. The man went away proclaiming. Literally, it's the word preaching. How much preacher training did he have? Not much. He went away proclaiming, preaching throughout the whole city of what great things Jesus had done for him. And we talk about the fact, and we make the point that are we, you know, as the phrase goes, are we witnesses today? No, we're not witnesses. Can we do what this man did and describe to the whole city the great things that Jesus has done for us? Can we describe our salvation? Can we tell how the gospel has revealed how we can be saved from our sins and the great opportunities to be part of his kingdom, that kingdom that, again, we just studied, people were willing to sell all that they had to be part of? It's interesting why different instructions than those previously he had healed. Do you remember what has he said to many already that he's healed?
Don't tell anybody.
Don't tell anybody. Isn't that interesting? Why the difference here?
I was actually thinking this area is probably populated more by Gentiles than Jewish people. Because no Jew would have been raising pigs. It's likely that a lot of the fear came from the fact that they had no idea what was going on, A, with this man, or B, with Jesus. They had no idea who he was or any of this. So that gives him like a different opportunity to go and preach to these people who have no idea about anything that has to do with Jesus.
Right. Good point. Why did Jesus oftentimes tell others, don't tell what had happened? Like in Mark chapter 1, what was the circumstance?
The leprous man.
After these miracles, what was going on around him? Remember, the whole city was at his door. And what do we read in Mark chapter 1 that he had to do to go find some time to pray? He had to get out. And then once his disciples found him, do you remember what he, you know, the disciples finally found him and they said, basically, what are you doing here? And Jesus said, rather than go back to that crowd, that mob of people that were looking for more miracles, Jesus said, I've got to do what? Verse 35, I've got to go somewhere else to preach, because that's what I came here for. I came to preach and teach. And oftentimes, the great crowds got in the way of his efforts to preach and teach. And perhaps in this situation, it was not, again, because of the nature of the people, the demographics of his people, that he was not having that problem. So what are the lessons to be learned and applied from this miracle? I've got my list.
Who Jesus is, first of all.
Okay.
The authority he has.
His authority is, we talk about his dunamis power and his exousia, his authority, both of these. So, yes, he has all authority. We need to fear and draw closer to Jesus. Again, not use his power and his authority and the fear that is due to him as a way to, you know, a reason to shrink away. But again, to come before him in humility. We need to realize, yet we're not to be afraid. And we need to proclaim to others the great things that Jesus has done. Again, his salvation that's offered. And again, I think there's some very practical lessons there for us.
But also with the man that he sent saying, go home and tell everybody what Jesus did for him. Because the people there were so afraid of Jesus and asked Jesus to leave, he possibly had an opportunity to preach to these people because they told Jesus to go away. But now he could tell them, if it's the same people, we don't know. Because
yeah.
It says he went to Decapolis. We don't know if some of these people were from that area. But the part of the lesson I get from this is we all have different opportunities.
Yes.
And there's opportunities that somebody else won't have that we have. So we need to pay attention to the opportunities
yes.
that we have.
That's a great lesson, to be opportunistic. All right. Next week, Lord willing, we're going to talk briefly about Matthew's feast, which I think actually chronologically happened earlier, but we're going to bring that up once again. And then we're going to talk about, if you'll read Matthew 9, 18-26, Mark 5, and Luke 8, and we're going to talk about Jairus' daughter and the miracle that was performed there.